This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The Taliban captured two major Afghan cities, the country's second and third largest after Kabul, and a strategic provincial capital on Thursday, further squeezing the embattled government just weeks before the end of the American military mission in Afghanistan. The seizure of Kandahar and Herat marks the biggest prizes yet for the Taliban, who have taken 12 of Afghanistan's 34 provincial capitals as part of a week-long blitz. The Taliban are estimated to now hold more than two-thirds of the country and are continuing to pressure government forces in several other provincial capitals. Just weeks away from completing its military withdrawal from Afghanistan, the United States is sending thousands of combat troops back to Kabul in a last-ditch attempt to move diplomatic personnel and Afghan allies out of harm's way. The move announced on Thursday by the State Department and the Pentagon comes as U.S. trained and equipped Afghan security forces continue to crumble in the face of an offensive by the Taliban. The first sets of reinforcements, 3,000 troops from three U.S. Marine and Army battalions, were expected to arrive in the Afghan capital of Kabul within 24 to 48 hours. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said the 3,000 troops who will be charged with securing the embassy and Hamid Karzai International Airport to facilitate the movement of all these people over the next couple of weeks. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. By a remote, this is VOA News. Six people were killed in a mass shooting in the city of Plymouth in southwestern England on Thursday evening. Police say two females, three males, including the suspect, died from gunshot wounds at the scene, and another woman died later at the hospital. Police initially described the shooting as a serious firearms incident and said the situation was contained. The police added that the incident was not related to terrorism. The United Kingdom has one of the lowest gun homicide rates in the world, and mass shootings are rare. Investigations into Thursday evening shootings are continuing. The United States is growing more racially diverse as the white population declined over the past decade. For the first time in the country's history, a new detailed look at the 2020 census shows. The Census Bureau, announcing Thursday its once-a-decade headcount, showed 331.4 million people living here in the United States last year, up 7.4% since 2010. People identifying as white remain the largest population group in the U.S., with the next largest group of people who identified as Hispanic or Latino. A COVID-19 surge that is sending hospitalizations to all-time highs in parts of the southern sections of the U.S. is also clobbering states that were once seen as pandemic success stories. Nationally, COVID-19 cases are averaging about 123,000 a day, a level not seen since February, the strongest in the South. The White House coronavirus coordinator says it's driving people to get their vaccinations. Two states considered pandemic success stories are now suffering. Oregon and Hawaii both reporting record cases and hospitalizations. In Oregon, Governor Kate Brown announcing nearly everyone will have to wear a mask again indoors in public spaces regardless of their vaccination status. Officials in Hawaii say the virus made it to the islands not that much through tourists, but rather residents who traveled to the mainland and brought it back with them. Zambian polling places stayed open after dark Thursday night as voters waited in the long lines to cast ballots while other officials began counting the results. Verifications counting takes place at the polling stations where the results are posted on the walls, according to Zambia's political system. Both President Edgar Lungu and rival Hakainde Hichilema have urged citizens to vote peacefully. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, August the 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Zambians stand out in high numbers in Thursday's general elections in a showdown between incumbent President Edgar Lungu and main opposition rival Hakainde Hichilema.
I've been here since 4:30. Actually, I didn't sleep. I've been waiting for this day for the past 5 years, and I'm glad it's here today.
VOA's Peter Claude is speaking to Zambians in the capital, Lusaka. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has acknowledged rampant corruption within his ruling African National Congress Party under former President Jacob Zuma.
Now, having drawn the line in the sand, we are going now to be very serious about dealing with corruption.
And it's been a tough year and a half across the continent with the global COVID-19 pandemic reversing some of the gains in fighting against poverty in many of Africa's rural communities. We'll look at the role of volunteers in helping in the fight against poverty in some of these communities around the continent. We have those stories plus sports right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Zambians stand out in high numbers to vote in Thursday's general elections in a showdown between incumbent President Edgar Lungu and main opposition rival Hakainde Hichilema. Analysts say that it is too early to know who the winner will be, as both parties claimed massive support among the 7 million registered voters. The highly charged campaign period saw the supporters of the two main parties clash in a run-up to voting, prompting President Edgar Lungu to deploy hundreds of police and the army. Zambians were mainly worried about the country's mounting debt and the struggling economy. Polling opened at 6 a.m. with long queues seen at voting booth in the capital, Lusaka. VOA's Peter Claude spoke to some of them as they waited their turn to cast their ballots.
My name is Cholwe Hampondela. Yeah, and I've been here since 4:30. Actually, I didn't sleep. I've been waiting for this day for the past 5 years, and I'm glad it's here today.
Why that enthusiasm?
Well, I just want to exercise my rights as a youth. I'm very excited about this one.
How has been the experience today before you vote?
It's been all right, though. It's exhausting standing in the queue, but it's not bad.
So what is your message to those who are yet to decide to vote today?
If you register to vote, there's no reason why you shouldn't vote. Just join the queue, vote, and make your leaders. Choose your leaders. Nobody else will choose your leaders for you.
I've seen a very large crowd outside. I understand you opened on time. What time did you see them?
The queue started as early as 23 hours. Yes.
Last night,
yes. They slept at the polling station. So by 04, it was packed. It was crowded.
Some people are saying there appears to be no social distancing. What's going on?
As you can see, there's no social distance here. Yeah, so unless maybe inside, but outside there's nothing. There's no social distance.
Zambians speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti in Lusaka, Zambia, as they waited their turn to vote. The country's electoral body is expected to announce the results early next week. I asked Peter Cloti if the Zambians that he spoke to were confident in the process.
What is the confidence level in the electoral commission? Because, you know, as we have seen on the continent, sometimes it doesn't matter who votes. It matters who counts the votes. And so are Zambians confident in the election commission?
Well, for those that I have spoken with, there are two school of thought again here. The opposition is of the view that the Electoral Commission of Zambia has yet to address all their concerns ahead of the elections. And they are critical that the elections are being organized and administered in an uneven playing field. However, the PF, the ruling party, is of the view that the Electoral Commission is doing what it can. It should be allowed to a free hand to operate, and that the winner or the result should be respected. Now, if you have any problem with the outcome of the result, there are avenues, legal avenues, for you to seek redress. Now, right. On the other hand, people are also enthusiastic about voting, and you could clearly see the division. Don't forget that there are 16 presidential candidates, and people are predicting that there could be spoilers. Some analysts are saying it looks like a toss-up between the president and the main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema. They can't predict who will win. Some people are saying there will be a runoff because of some of these so-called minor political parties, including Chishela Kateka, who is the only female presidential candidate. And for the first time, you have five major political parties all fielding women as their vice presidential candidate. So it's an interesting dynamic here in Lusaka.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. And still in Southern Africa, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has acknowledged rampant corruption within his ruling African National Congress Party under former President Jacob Zuma. Addressing a judicial inquiry on graft this week, Ramaphosa said a line had been drawn in the sand and said the party is going to be very serious in dealing with corruption. Linda Gaftash has more in this report from Johannesburg.
Better late than never. That's what South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa told a graft inquiry about his party beginning to clean up years of corruption. The Judicial Commission is investigating the looting of the state's coffers under former President Jacob Zuma, in which Zuma's business associates allegedly won state contracts and undue influence over government. Ramaphosa was deputy president under Zuma for 4 years before succeeding him in 2018. He told the commission the ANC party is changing its ways.
We are prepared to hang out our linen in the open, and now, having drawn the line in the sand, we are going now to be very serious about dealing with corruption. You may well say, well, why didn't you do so over a period of so many years? But it's better late than never.
But after widespread riots last month that were fueled by frustrations over the state's failures and worsening poverty, political analysts say better late may not be good enough. Lisa Jernberg is an independent international relations expert in Johannesburg.
Civil society would like to see much stronger condemnations and actual action. I think that's the biggest frustration. It's not that we think that, you know, Ramaphosa is pro-corruption. I think we're all confident that he is anti-corruption, but there needs to be more actual prosecution and action.
Ramaphosa claims to be in the dark about many corrupt dealings and kickbacks to politicians and their associates during the Zuma administration. He's also said he chose to stay in politics and move up the ranks in order to bring about positive change. Narnia Bowler-Muller, a professor with South Africa's Human Science Research Council, says he's living up to his word.
He's done a lot in the sense of fixing institutions, and that's so important when it comes to fighting corruption. So he's made really good appointments. He strengthened the SIU.
The SIU, or the Special Investigations Unit, that looks into claims by whistleblowers. However, Jernberg says many South Africans see the long-ruling ANC as synonymous with corruption.
It's really hard to disentangle these corruption networks within the ANC. The other concern is that, obviously, the ANC itself has become completely embedded within the state and the state within the ANC, so there is no clear delineation anymore between party and state.
Lawyers at the inquiry have tried to determine where the party's influence over government decisions begins and ends, and how party loyalty contributed to corruption being swept under the rug. Bowler-Muller says Ramaphosa needs to be clear about his priorities going forward.
He has to make a choice, really. He has to decide whether he's going to be acting in the interests of South Africa and South Africans, or if he's going to continue to protect the bad apples in the ANC.
After holding more than 400 hearings, the inquiry is due to close at the end of September. Presiding Judge Raymond Zondo will issue his findings, and the country is waiting to see if the so-called bad apples will finally be prosecuted. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Bank estimates that 80% of people in African countries, especially the youth, work in the informal sector, often for very low earnings. Lack of job opportunities has also contributed to high levels of underemployment and unemployment among college graduates. As the world commemorated World Youth Day this week, the UN says that some of these issues around youth unemployment can be solved if countries leverage new technologies to encourage job creation through entrepreneurship. Maureen Ojambo reports that despite some of these challenges, Kenyan youth are in many ways ahead of the game.
In a report, the United Nations says that every year younger people pursue their transition to adulthood through education. This has caused higher demand for post-basic education as the bridge between the aspirations of young people and the promises of the better future through paid employment. As joblessness among the youths hit many in Kenya, there are young Kenyans doing commendable jobs for the community. Kennedy Odede started Shofco Foundation in Kibera Slums as a young man struggling to save young girls and boys from the slum hardships.
And as you can see, later on, we were able to start a school for girls that you see that have been doing well in the exams. I didn't want to build many schools, as you know, but the agenda was I wanted to what is called to change the way people think on women. So by having this tiny school in the middle of the slum, it was powerful because when people look at it, now you want your daughter, your niece to be like that. So you change the mindset of people.
Odede said that many youths are still turning to crime for lack of jobs and that there is need for youth appointments in government.
Youths are not in the government enough. They are being taken as a token and the youths are really tired. They know what they want. So I think every government should come with a declaration on that day, what they're going to do for the youth. So right now, like to you, apart from Kibera and everywhere else you see this, and your friends will tell you this now, the crime rate has become higher.
Another Kenyan, Lillian Ngala, founder of Lillian Ngala Foundation, builds homes for widows in Kenya. She claims most of them are neglected in the community.
Having been raised by a widow myself, growing up and even now, I still see widows living in abject poverty, where most of them do get robbed of their houses and even their assets once their husbands are no more. Besides the widows pillar, whereby we build the houses for the widows, we also have two other pillars, which is one, the inclusive empowerment, whereby we work closely with the women, the youth, and the people living with the disabilities.
Lillian says lack of resources makes her not fulfill all the requests she receives from the community.
Being an individual, majorly the sole contributor, it becomes very difficult for me to fulfill all the pressing projects that I do receive on a daily basis because we have so many widows out there and they don't know who to turn to, and therefore when they get to hear about the Ngala Foundation, then the requests are so many.
With the theme of International Youth Day 2021 being transforming food systems, youth innovation for humans and planetary health, Emmanuel Atamba is a young Kenyan fighting for rights to safe food for all.
Food is a human right. It's not just something, you know, we are doing as a political favor or something like that. So conversations around food systems are evolving quite rapidly. There's a lot of new information coming up every day, the new challenges, you know. Who knew that there could be mercury in sugar? This work is not something that you plan in January and know exactly the conversations you're going to have throughout.
With youths in Africa making up to 70% of African population, the United Nations says through youth education, engagement, innovation, and entrepreneurial solutions, this year's International Youth Day aims to provide a platform for young people. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Now, it has been a tough year and a half across the continent, with the global COVID-19 pandemic reversing some of the gains in fighting against poverty in many of Africa's rural communities. Some of the frontline work in this fight is being done by young volunteers who commit their time and resources to work in places far away from their homes. Core Africa is one of the organizations that recruits and places young African volunteers in remote communities to work on high-impact projects around poverty alleviation. The founder, Liz Fanning, tells me that Core Africa volunteers are helping the communities fight COVID-19 through education and hands-on support.
Core Africa, I guess in the simplest terms, it's like Peace Corps for young Africans to serve like Peace Corps volunteers in their own countries. I started it because I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Morocco back in the 1990s, and I used to meet young Moroccans who were college educated, and you know, they would ask me about what I was doing to help people in their country and what it was like in the rural areas in their country. And they would inevitably ask if they could be a Peace Corps volunteer so they could help their country. And I had to say, no, I'm sorry, it's only for Americans. So You know, that question really dogged me for 20 years. And I eventually started CORE Africa to give young Africans the chance to serve like I did and get the transformative experience and the personal and professional benefits that last a lifetime, which is really extraordinary.
Of being a volunteer,
of service, of getting out of your comfort zone, of helping, you know, and building the network as well. You build that you're part of this community of other volunteers that, you know, you have so much in common and go through this really extreme experience with them. You build a very strong support group that becomes your network.
Right. And your family. How do you recruit your volunteers and who is eligible to volunteer?
Well, we just finished recruiting volunteers for the next group, but we'll start again next spring. It's college educated, although we've made exceptions if you have equivalent experience, 4 years of work experience, but mostly have to be 21. Most of our volunteers are in their 20s, and we look mostly for judgment. We look for maturity, but we also look for a sense of adventure and people who are really eager to help and to find their place in the world. People who are ready to, you know, it really is for people in their young 20s because it's before you get on the professional and the personal, you know, the career track and family and all that. It's like taking a year after college to do something completely different, but also apply what you've been learning in a really unique situation.
Talk about some of the work that you're doing currently. I know 2020 was a very challenging year. 2021 still is. We're in the midst of a global pandemic. Well, what are some of the projects that your volunteers are working on, especially during this time of this global pandemic that has hit hard many of the rural communities around the continent?
Absolutely. Well, all of our volunteers always have been doing projects that build resilient communities. You know, the way we differ from Peace Corps, they don't go in as teachers or with a job to do. They go in, we train them in human-centered design. So it helps them facilitate conversations, make sure everybody's heard, bring people to consensus about what they want for their community. And then their role is to be a liaison to outside resources or to help them create that project. And usually the projects are all over the map, but they're usually things like a well or, you know, refinishing a school or a school library or a women's cooperative, a lot of agricultural projects, animal husbandry.
And you talked about farming and agriculture, and I imagine this is a very challenging time in many communities around the continent, especially because due to the pandemic. I know many people who have moved from these urban centers to move back to rural areas because they have easier access to food, and therefore I imagine that some of your work around farming or around agriculture has changed. Let's talk about how this model, the human-centered design model. How does the CORE Africa model reflect some of the well-known practices in community development?
Sure, absolutely. And I want to come back to COVID because I really didn't answer that part of it. And that's a really big part of it last year. But for human-centered design, it's a structure to the facilitation process. It's sort of tools to help the volunteers lead the process. And the process is about making sure that the community has ownership of whatever gets done, that this really comes from them. And it part of the human-centered design approach is that it's about the volunteers not imposing what they think needs to get done. And that for the volunteers to go through that experience, it brings them the kind of humility that it takes to help people. It's the opposite of going in as the savior and bringing a project that you think they need. It's the opposite of that. It's really about listening deeply and engaging people and making sure that whatever gets done, people have ownership. People are required, the community is required to pay 10% of the cost of the project themselves in cash. We've made exceptions because there are some extremely poor communities. It makes a huge difference in what they say they want in the project that they decide to do, and also in the sustainability of the project, because it gives the people not just skin in the game, which is really important, but also the dignity. You know, they're customers, they're not charity beneficiaries.
That was Liz Fanning, the founder of CORE Africa, a Richter in New York. And it's time time for Daybreak Africa Sports, we go to Abuja with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sport with the latest FIFA rankings. Senegal retained their status as Africa's highest ranked team after climbing one place to 21st in the latest FIFA rankings released on Thursday. Tunisia's Carthage Eagles, who dropped 2 points, are now 28th globally and second in Africa after accruing 1,515 points. In form, Algeria climbed 12 places to 30th in the world and 3rd in Africa, and Morocco are now 32nd and 4th in Africa. The Super Eagles of Nigeria dropped 7 places to 34th position. Following their slide, the Eagles are now in 5th place in Africa. Staying with football news, president of the Ghana Football Association, Kurt Okrako, has sent a strong warning to clubs implicated in the match-fixing and betting scandal to stop calling his phone. An alleged match-fixing scandal rocked the final match day of the 2020-2021 Ghana Premier League as Ashanti Gold suspiciously defeated Inter Allies 7-2 with an Inter Allies player scoring 2 deliberate own goals. The Criminal Investigation Department of the Ghana Police Service has formed a strong team to investigate the match-fixing and bribery allegations. Ghana Football Association president unequivocally advised people implicated in the scandal to stop calling him.
Our football has and was attacked by faceless cowards. I'm talking about betting. I'm repeating myself. Our sport has been attacked by faceless cowards. And it is my responsibility and it's the responsibility of our executive to defend the passion of the nation. Everybody who has played a part, I'm talking about the faceless courts, will face it. We'll clean our sports and we'll bring confidence to a sport that fits me, that fits all of us here.
Former Ugandan Cranes captain Dennis Onyango is set for his sensational return to the national team. Dennis Onyango announced his retirement from international football on April 12th after over 16 years of service. The Mamelodi Sundowns short stopper is set to be included in coach Michu Serdarovic's squad ahead of the start of the 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifiers at the start of next month. In women's football news, hosts and defending champions South Africa have been drawn in a tricky pool for the 2021 Regional COSAFA Women's Championship that will be staged in Nelson Mandela Bay from September 15th to the 26th. South African national women's side, Bayana Bayana, who have won the last 4 championships, will take on Angola, Malawi, and Mozambique in Group A, with only the top team guaranteed a place in the semifinals. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Friday, August the 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend, Africa.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.